When a sequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes was announced, we had to wonder, could it possibly maintain its surprising level of quality? But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes went on to be one of the best science fiction films of the past 20 years. Welcome everyone to the Atomic Cinema Experiment. I am Peter, and joining me, as always, is David.
I come in peace.
This is a science fiction movie podcast. We get together or we talk about a sci-fi movie we watch. It's quite that simple. And today we're returning to the Planet of the Apes franchise for the middle chapter of the modern trilogy. We did Rise a little bit ago. Today It's time for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. So we'll start spoiler-free, as we always do, and we'll give you a warning if we get spoilers. And before we get started, I'll just remind everyone that if you are enjoying the show and you're on YouTube, please do hit the like button. It helps us out a bunch. And if you're enjoying the show, regardless of where you're enjoying it, you can support everything by going over to patreon.com/mailfuzzTV, and you can get access to some bonus shows that me and David do every month. I'll tell you more about them at the end. But yeah, so, yes. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Which I'm still going to argue, poor naming scheme. Very bad naming scheme, because as I was going to watch this movie, despite the fact that we just did Rise, like, less than a month ago our time, I still forgot, and I was typing in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, because it makes so much more sense that Dawn is before Rise to me.
That does make sense, although I would argue this should not be called Rise either. I would
argue
this should be called War, because it's the one that's got most of a war in it. And then the third one should probably be called Rise. But I mean,
to be fair, I've never seen the third one, so I don't know how warlike it is, but fair enough.
I would argue this one, it has more war. And that's not a critique necessarily. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the third one. I'm just saying this one has what I would describe more of like the actual build of a war as opposed to, it doesn't matter. Anyway, that's for when we get back to this franchise with war. Today, we're talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And it's obviously Rise came out, kind of proved everyone that, hey, maybe this should exist. Maybe we were all just a bit too cynical. And to be fair, I don't feel bad about it, because Hollywood has earned that cynicism. But, you know, granted, Dawn, a bit more hopeful. But there was also that kind of thing like, okay, they're changing director. That could be a problem, because now it's Matt Reeves. Now,
Who the hell is this Matt Reeves guy? I'm sure he's never going to do anything well.
Well, yeah, in hindsight, that's obviously maybe a funny statement to make. But at the time, he'd done Cloverfield and the Let the Right One In remake. It wasn't like his career. Like, and those weren't bad movies. I'm not saying that. But,
yeah,
like, this was very much his first great movie. And I think it was very, there was a lot of reasons to be skeptical again getting into this one, because it was a different director, because, well, they kind of got really lucky that that one turned out so good last time. Like, the idea that they were going to match that again is always kind of daunting. Like, you're doing a follow-up. There's a high chance that it's going to be diminishing returns. But, you know, just to get be blunt with it, no, they surpassed it. They surpassed it in phenomenal ways.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think what wowed me the most is how immediately right off the bat, I mean, this was only a 3-year gap between the Rise and Dawn.
Yes.
Immediately, I was taken back by how much better all of the special effects seemed. Even by, like, modern standards, this feels like it stands up pretty much completely amongst them the whole way through.
Yeah, it's an all notch up, and they were already great in Rise, but, and don't get me wrong, like, you can, there's the odd movement or something that just sort of gives it away. There's just little moments. But given how much time the screen is taken up with CG characters, but I think what's more impressive is not just how lifelike it looks the vast majority of the time, it's that you genuinely, and we said this about Rise as well, to be fair, but now it's even more broad, is that you can see the performances of the actors in these characters. And that
I can really feel Andy Serkis like acting behind that rather than just being more physical with it.
It's so impressive. And now we're dealing with even more ape characters. We're dealing with them being more of a protagonist force. We've got, you know, conflict amongst ape characters. We've got young characters, old characters. We've got an entire suite of just, you know, different types of ape, and I don't mean different species of it, I mean different personalities of ape, and I think that's very impressive, and it's almost like Rise was a proof of concept, and then this was like the true, this is what we can do now. If there's a movie that, to me, that feels like a testament of like what we can do now with modern technology when it's used well and it's used with a good script and all the other elements that make a movie good, this is very much kind of that. It's like, hey, this is what we can do now.
No, I agree. I think that this is, it's incredible, because it's one of those things where it's part of a franchise, it's a sequel, it's something that Hollywood resurrected like years and years and years after the original. It's something that, as far as Tim Burton is concerned, it was already dead. So the fact that something like this was able to come about and actually have some real artistry to it and feel like it actually had something to say in terms of a script, in terms of a story being told, that's kind of incredible to me. That it's not just another thing that's shelled out by Hollywood.
I mean, technically, this is number 8, right? If you if you count from the start, this is the 8th Planet of the Apes movie. So that just puts it in perspective. And something that you were kind of scratching at there with that last statement is that this is... And I mean this, like, this is going to sound almost like a pretentious thing to say, but this is true science fiction. This is a movie that is got a, it's got a theme, it's got a moral, it's got something that it's trying to get across. Yes, it's about this post-apocalyptic world where apes are in a conflict with man. But fundamentally, it's saying something about society. It's saying something about every conflict that we've ever had in our dumb species. And it's so good at it. It's so good at talking about how conflict arises from two sides, how certain people on either side create distrust, how difficult it is to achieve peace when two sides are hesitant to do so. It ultimately, I would describe this movie as a tragedy, where, and every time I watch it, I do the same thing, where there's a bit of hope, where I'm like, maybe this time it'll work out. Maybe this time we won't have the war part. Maybe it'll just be nice, and all the characters that are trying to be good will achieve the goodness.
Maybe I accidentally downloaded the alternate cut this time. There's an alternate cut, right, guys? Right?
So, and the fact that it makes me hope for that every time. And this is the movie as well. That so the main human character is Jason Clarke, plays him, Malcolm. This was the movie that made me like him. And I have thus been disappointed with every single movie he's been in since, because he keeps being in trash. And I'm like, remember, Clark, my man, you were in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and now you're in Terminator Genesis. Now you're in Winchester. Now you're at the Pet Sematary remake. I can keep going. Just nothing but turds left and right, as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, I'm looking through his filmography. I can't say there's a single movie in here that I'm like, oh, that was really good. He was apparently in Oppenheimer, but I couldn't remember who he was.
Oh, yeah, he was, yeah. He was... He was at the hearing and the sort of small
the confirmation
room. Yeah,
okay.
He was asking a lot of the questions.
Oh, okay. So not a major enough role to really do a bad job at it.
Well, to be fair, I wasn't critiquing him and saying that he was doing bad jobs in these movies. I was saying that he kept ending up in just garbage movies.
Yeah, that's fair.
So yeah, but I mean, obviously you guys look Gary Oldman in here in a supporting role. Kerry Russell is in here, but it's also notable that along with Andy Serkis, we even have a couple of names that people might recognize for the apes themselves. Koba is now played by Toby Kebbell, so they got like a bigger actor, I guess, if you want to call him that.
Yeah.
Because it's a more prominent role this time, since he is kind of the antagonist ape. We also have Judy Greer as Cornelia. Which...
Yeah, I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, that's just kind of like a surprise. Like, okay, all right. I guess she's stealthily in even more things than I realized. So,
In terms of one last character here, not even a big role, really. Kind of the dickish human in the group. He is played by Kirk. God, I'm going to butcher this. Acevedo, I believe.
Sounds right.
He's not a huge actor and all that, but I literally just last night before watching this, finished watching Fringe, and he is a major recurring character on that, so just good to see him here as well.
Yeah, he's actually oh god, what was it? He's really bad in something else, but he's fine in Fringe and he's fine here. But he was really bad in something else. I can't remember.
There's his big titles are Band of Brothers, Thin Red Line, and Oz.
No, it wasn't any of those.
He was also in 27 episodes of Arrow, which I'm assuming is something you would have not liked.
It was probably that. It was probably that. It was terrible. And
also the TV series of 12 Monkeys.
I never watched that. I can't comment.
That's fair. Same.
I think what else was getting me as I was watching it again today is that just how fantastic some of the visuals are, and I'm not just talking about the CG of the apes. I'm talking about the cinematography, like the there's moments where there's like two apes like in silhouette with fire behind them, kind of like having this cinematic moment. There's a moment where like the glow of a lighter just lights up Koba's face, and it's just like this really eerie kind of thing. Like, I think
during the final fight, the one that got me was there's this essentially a oneer that's done from the viewpoint of like a tank, and the tank is just rotating, showing this massive like fight scene going on.
Oh yeah,
it's so incredible looking.
Although that's far from the final fight. That's like over halfway into the movie.
That's true. Yeah, I guess there is more to the end of it. It just feels so much like a final fight.
Yeah, no, that's like your middle, just past the middle point of the movie where things really shake up. That's the big money shot. That's the big set piece kind of moment. Yeah, but like it was surprisingly just how many little quiet like beautiful moments there were, kind of sprinkled out. So I think the direction's even stronger than the last one. I think the script is pretty airtight because it is this really solid science fiction story, and not just because it's about talking apes in a post-apocalypse, but because it really is trying to like analyze something in society with what it's doing.
Yeah, it's using a different frame of reference to tell something about humanity.
Yeah, which is really what all science fiction is supposed to be. Obviously, some just ends up being a bit more shallow than that, because, you know, flashy, flashy, bang, bang, you know, enjoy the pretty lights, don't ask too many questions, go home in this fight. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're going for, but this is aiming a little bit higher than that, and I think it's impressive, especially in an era where we're already deep into the MCU by this point. In terms of like overall Hollywood, sort of what the vibe was like at the time, and this is a blockbuster that's got a budget probably at least of $200 million that is doing this, and it kind of is almost like reigniting a bit of hope that hey, a big budget movie can be this, right?
Yeah, but again, it's one of those things that just because it is already part of a franchise, I think that a lot of people just immediately dismiss it. Immediately they say like, ah, yeah, this is another one of those like Transformers kind of movies where it's just a bunch of big action set pieces without even knowing the deeper stuff that is inside of it, you know?
I mean, I think those people would probably end up being bored if they make that assumption, because like, yeah, there's a big set piece just over halfway through, but like it's all pretty quiet and like sort of slow building before that, and I mean that in a good way. It's a character drama.
No, I'm just saying like the outward assumption of it, because like again, I watched Rise. I keep doing that. I watched Rise.
Okay, at a certain
times.
Point, this is on you. Okay, at a certain point,
I'm
an idiot.
I get it. Yeah, but still. I watched Rise a few times. I watched Dawn in the theaters once, and then I never watched again, and I never came around to getting around to War. But even with having seen that, I felt like there was always kind of this air of when they were released of it just being treated in the same sort of way of other franchise movies, like the MCU coming out, like Transformers movies, where it seems like the studio's putting it out more as a cash grab than it actually being something. But once you go see the movie itself, that's clearly not the case. It's clear that they're actually putting a lot of effort and work into this, and it's much more than just, hey, let's make a bunch of money.
Well, I mean, to be clear, the studio are just doing a cash grab. It's the people the movie that are, you know, putting in the effort and actually making it more than that. It gets funding because the previous movie was successful and because it gets to use a franchise name, right? And it's kind of up to the artistic people that are doing the projects to actually try and make it more than that. And this is just one of those perfect storms where it all just kind of like clicks together, where everyone was the right person for the job. And like Rise is very good, and it's still very important. Like, you know, so many things in this that are continuing thematically from Rise or payoff, at least for Caesar's character and where he's come from and how he views human beings versus all of the other apes and things like that, all comes into play.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is fantastic, and I dare say, and maybe this is a controversial take, I do think it's even better than the original Planet of the Apes. And I know that that might be considered spicy by some people, but I genuinely think it is better. And I love that first movie. This is not a knock on that first movie.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't quite want to say whether or not, but it's definitely something that I had a lot more engagement with. It's something that as I was sitting there, I felt like every scene was just kind of drawing me in deeper and deeper. And something that the original Planet of the Apes gets is that it's essentially just a Twilight Zone story, which means a lot of like philosophizing directly, like them just talking about the deeper implications of things. Whereas I think this movie, it really explores the deeper implications of things. It takes these different factions of not only humans and apes, but then even within that, little subgroups. And it says, okay, what happens when you put all these people together? And how do we like play that out? What happens in the end here? And like you said, it's kind of a tragedy the way that it plays out.
Yeah, for sure. So honestly, I don't know how much more we want to talk about before we get to some spoilers and get into it, but...
Yeah, I mean, I can't... I will say that while the special effects are pretty amazing, I will say that the set, like the music, the score, it's good, it's unintrusive, but I did notice this one recurring thing that kind of, at least for the first half of the movie, put me off a little bit, which is... Anytime that, because at this point, I mean, there are apes in the woods. That's not a spoiler. The apes are in the woods and the humans are kind of walking around occasionally. Every time there's a human that's just kind of walking through the woods to some extent, there's this loud, like, I don't want to say Hans Zimmer, like, bass thing going on to it, but that's kind of what it is. It's just this, like, suspenseful boom. And I get the point of it, but, like, it, at a certain point, I started noticing it, and that's when it became intrusive to me, when I was, like, just waiting for this, like, boom noise to hit in the background and say, oh, that's right, guys, you're supposed to feel suspenseful right now.
Okay. I did like the use of, not even the music, I mean, I guess it's technically still music, but it's not the musical part of it, but the sort of the chanting hum from the start of 2001 A Space Odyssey is used at the start of this movie, and I guess it kind of thematically makes sense, because the whole thing in 2001 is that the apes are evolving and learn to use tools. So we start off this movie with the apes hunting, you know, very intelligently. They're not just, you know, they're Caesar's like calling out commands. They're almost like Navy SEALs, like in hiding, waiting till they attack the deer kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, so I kind of like the spin on that, because it's like, oh no, these apes are like super evolving. They are way beyond what their status quo was just a few short years ago. 10 years, I think they point out.
Yeah, no, there's a 10-year gap here. I think this is supposed to take place, because last one took place by the end of the movie in 2016. So this one's supposed to be 2026.
Well, I didn't realize that in the last one.
Based off trivia. I don't know if they ever said it, but that's based off trivia. Apparently, it's supposed to be in 2026.
I mean, maybe there's something you can notice in the movie that tells you that. What it sounds like to me, though, is they're assuming, because there's a 5-year time jump, that the bit at the start was set present day when the movie came out, and when it jumps 5 years, then we're 5 years in the future.
Right.
Which, I don't know. Like, to me, my instinct would be say, no, the bit at the start was 5 years ago, and the present day stuff is now. But, I mean, again...
I'll tear that down with, I think that it explains more if there's a 5-year into the future time jump to say why there would then be astronauts heading to Mars in that story.
Okay.
I think that it's applicable to say that that's a future sort of thing.
That's fair. And like I say, there very well could be an Easter egg in the corner somewhere saying 2026 on a fridge calendar or something that I just didn't notice. But yeah, fair enough. The beauty of it, though, doesn't really matter. Year this is set in, because at a certain point it just becomes timeless. It's like, okay, it's just society's ended, right? We're here now.
That sort of thing. Is by the time society ends, timekeeping doesn't matter anymore. All you have to know is this is eventually. This is at some point.
So, all right then. So we'll get into it. Spoilers then for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And yes, Dave is going to remind you at the end of the show, he's got his homework.
What? I wasn't going to say anything like that, but if you want me to say something, sure. At the end of this episode, yes, I do have some homework, which is where I go back and I talk about a movie that Pete and Tara did before my time, because I am woefully unprepared for all things sci-fi, so I gotta build myself up a little bit.
Yes. So, spoilers then for the movie. I love how layered and complex the characters are in this film, and I think one of the things that was really sticking out to me on this viewing is that, I mean, the first time I saw it, obviously I get this idea that you've got both sides, you've got Jason Clarke in the human side, you've got Caesar in the ape side, who both want peace, who are both going up against all these obstacles that keep trying to get in the way of that peace, you know, whether it be, Carver, the asshole human, try to, be racist towards the apes or bring in the gun or whatever it is. Yeah. Or it's Koba on the ape side, who's just so hateful and just full of revenge and just wants to fight the second that humans are around, and never really wavering from that. So all that stuff, yeah, like that was like a first time viewing thing, obviously. It's all very surface. But what I was feeling on this viewing in particular and really appreciating is that Caesar, by the end of the movie, there's a great line at the end, just before the big final fight between Caesar and Koba, where Koba says Caesar's weak, and Caesar says Koba weaker. And what I like about that line is that, to me, it's written that way very specifically for Caesar to not disagree that he's weak, because I think he does have some guilt that he didn't recognize. Part of this movie's, or part of his story in this movie, is that he had basically his own sense of prejudice, and that he even admits that he thought apes were better than humans, and that hubris is part of why he couldn't predict what was going to happen with Koba. He thought, no, we're better, we won't act like them, but then he's realizing, no, we're actually the exact damn same. And that's something I think you recognize when you're watching the movie long before he does, is that as soon as Koba is saying, no, we must fight, we can't let the humans do this, we can never trust the humans are monsters, we have to fight. That idea that Caesar's realizing in his own way, even though Koba's the one who clearly hates the humans and wants to just always go against them, in his own way, Caesar's attitude towards humans also kind of doomed him to this path. And I think that little subtlety is something I really appreciate in the story.
Yeah, no, I definitely. I think it's incredible the way the story's told here, in that it's basically a parable, I guess, if you want to say that way, of... Mm-hmm. It's very easy to act in self-interest. And there's nothing inherently wrong with acting in self-interest, but it ends up being very much warlike in that way. And it's a lot harder to seek peace, to seek understanding between different people. And it doesn't even have to be different groups. Like, even just between Caesar and Koba, it's difficult to try to find a level ground where both of them agree with the action being taken, even within the same group. So I think there's a lot to it to say that Caesar, yes, he doesn't see himself as perfect, but I do think that this movie does a good job of saying, during this time jump, during these 10 years, things have been pretty good for the apes overall. Like, everything is pretty much fine.
Yeah, they've got a little society going. They've built this kind of tree fortress, I guess.
Yep. Caesar's got a wife, an older son, and then a brand new born baby son that we see in the movie. So
Maurice is teaching the school. We see like a school style setup.
I'm just going to say now, Maurice is the best. Like, I don't even know why I like him so much, but just everything this movie does, I'm like, nah, man, Maurice is awesome. Like, if anything bad happens to Maurice, I'm rioting.
Yeah, Rocket's back as well. Although Rocket probably has the least to do. But it's notable that his son, who's like friends with Caesar's son, his name's Ash, he's kind of got a couple of prominent beats, so he is in there. And Rocket is back again, the third one, as is as Maurice. I did feel bad, though, because like, it's clear that the gorilla who was with them in the last movie is there, and like, you know, sometimes when it's grouped into like, here's the people that see, or the apes that Caesar trusts, like that gorilla...
Was he? I thought that the gorilla was shot down, like the one that they originally had with the group at the end of the last movie.
Oh, did he die in the last movie? Maybe
I thought he did.
Yeah, because there was a gorilla with them, right, at various points, and I was thinking, oh, it kind of sucks how they're, like, these other ones are all getting, like, character moments, and, like, their names are being mentioned. But, yeah, if you're right, maybe, if the gorilla did die at the end of the last one, then fair enough.
Yeah, I thought he did a full sacrifice for Caesar. At least that's how I remember it.
I think you're right now that you're saying it. That just slipped my mind.
Yeah, but no, I actually, the first thing that popped in my mind, and it's weird that I jumped to this, is The Walking Dead. And somewhere around like season 3-4, somewhere around there, they have their own little society thing built up, but they have like the central council, which is the main characters we've been following since the beginning of the show. And I always, when I was watching that, felt like it was weird. Like it didn't feel like it was earned that these people are kind of the central council. Like I felt like there should have been other people brought on. But then with these guys, with Maurice, Rocket, Koba, and Caesar, I'm like, nah, this makes sense. This feels good. It feels good that they're the ones who are, like, making the calls on this society.
Yeah, they
and I can't tell you why, but it works.
No, it does make sense, because they started this, and Caesar was the first one to be smart, and this is his brainchild. He built all this.
Mm-hmm. I especially love Rocket, because obviously Rocket was the one who was kind of, like, dominant over Caesar briefly in the last movie, but now he's straight up Caesar's like number one main man. He's like, nah, I'll do whatever Caesar wants. He's awesome.
Well, I think one of the great things about the story between Caesar and Koba in this is that the opening scene has them working together as a team, where Koba saves Caesar from a bear, right? So we get this fantastic opening. It starts up in the close-up of the eyes of Caesar. He's in the trees. The camera pulls back.
They've got war paint on.
Yeah, you get a 2001 kind of right going as they're chasing the deer. But it's Caesar's son who sort of jumps out without sort of looking or thinking, and a bear comes out. Caesar sort of jumps out to defend him, and they're basically just sort of stalling until Koba jumps in and spears the bear. And Caesar's like, oh, thank you, Koba. And it shows you how well they're working together. And it perhaps, you assume this past decade of being in the forest without humans, it has been quite tranquil. It's when the humans show back up and all of a sudden, Koba's like hatred, his prejudice has to come out. And the beauty of it as well is that as much as Koba is a villainous character in this, and he makes choices, he does things that are absolutely villainous, and you do hate him by the end of the movie, you can never blame him for how he feels about the humans. Never.
No, this movie does a great job at starting Caesar and Koba in the exact same spot. They both want what's best for their ape society. They both are basically leaders of the group. But it is very clear that Caesar always wants to err on the side of peace. He doesn't want to sacrifice anybody, whether that be ape or human. Whereas Koba is all out like war-minded. He wants revenge for the things that were done to him as like a testing chimp. And he wants, even if it means at the sacrifice of his own apes, he wants revenge on these humans. And it's two very different paths, but it does a great job at showing that despite Koba's opposite of Caesar, he's not wrong in a lot of ways.
I mean, think of how many like war movies you've watched where there's the one military guy whose response is always that he wants to go and fight. Yeah. We have to go drop some nukes first to show that we're stronger. Like, there's always that type of character, pretty much, in a lot of war movies and stories. And Koba very much fits into that, and arguably in some ways more justifiable. But of course, Caesar has met nice humans. He's you know, he was raised by a human. He sees people to sympathize with to a point. We get introduced to the society and the wife and all that stuff. There's a neat thing here where obviously we're dealing with apes, so like Caesar's son, he gets that scar from the bear early on, so you can always tell it's him. Koba, of course, always has that distinct scar on his eye and all that stuff.
Yeah, you can tell everybody, like, Maurice's, I might be wrong, but I think Maurice is the only, like, actual orangutan there. I don't think there's another one at any point.
At least that they focus on, because I remember there'd been a bunch at the bridge last movie, so I suspect there is some around, but we never really focus on any other orangutans.
And then Caesar's the only one who, throughout the movie, pretty much always stands fully upright. Like, he's the one who stands tall over all these other hunching apes.
And of course, he's speaking. Like,
Yeah, true.
I mean, Koba does speak over the course of the movie as well, But the apes, for the most part, use sign language. That's typically what they're doing. And that's something that I love. When I first saw this, and then I was sitting in the cinema, and they started signing, and it was subtitled, I went, holy shit, we're getting what is effectively a foreign language movie with apes. I kind of love it.
Yeah, absolutely. I did notice, there. I don't know very much in terms of sign language, but the one that I know for sure is thank you, which is your hand to your mouth and pulling it away. And then when Caesar was attacked, he says, thank you, Koba. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do that sign, which means this isn't American Sign Language. This is some like new language that has been cooked up here via the apes.
They have developed it themselves. That makes some sense. So, yeah, the big inciting incident is that Caesar's son is Blue Eyes and Ash, who is Rocket's son, are fishing together. They're messing around. They seem to be friendly. And they're walking through the woods, and they bump into Carver, who immediately freaks out. And it does feel like, I think because we start with the apes in this movie, the humans feel dangerous the first time you see them, and you're instantly kind of on edge, like, oh, what's he going to do? And, of course, he pulls out a gun, you hear a gunshot, and it's a quiet forest, so this gunshot is, like, heard for miles, and everyone jumps up and goes swinging to go see what's happening. And we get this initial standoff where the rest of the group of humans, which is, you know, made up of Malcolm, the Jason Clarke character, Ellie, who's Kerry Russell's character, and his son, his teenage son, played by Cody Smith McPhee, who, funny enough, was when he was younger, was in The Road, so he's actually post-apocalyptic experienced, I guess.
He knows how to live out here.
Yeah, because a line later on, which is a great little line, actually, because they don't really delve into it, but Jason Clarke says, you know, my boy's seen things that no child should ever have to see, so we're not losing the civilization we're building. And they don't really go into it beyond that, but it implies that things got dark. Like, they've like sort of like clawed back some civilization in this little community they've built, but things are implied to have gotten really bad at some point before that.
Well, just to take a brief little detour here, the actual like opening sequence.
It's almost like a previously on, but it's just explaining the virus. Yeah,
it's straight up. It's just saying through like your stereotypical newscasters, and they show like, you know, how it basically broke down, and they show, and let me tell you here, living post COVID hits different. This hits really, really different.
Yeah, even there's a moment actually later on when Carver is getting all kind of racist about the apes. And he's like, hey, it's called the simian flu for a reason. And that was reminding me so much of assholes saying, it came from China. It was them that did it to us during the pandemic. And I'm like, God damn it, this is hitting so hard right now.
This movie is very prophetic like that. But the point of that earlier scene, though, obviously it's just kind of a breakdown of, okay, 10 years have passed and we're just showing humanity has fallen, essentially, to the point where the last few broadcasts that go out are saying, like, government function has been suspended, and there's some voiceover narration saying, like, whoever didn't get killed by the flu is going to get killed by each other. Like, this is the end of humanity. So one of the things that we said at the end of the last review, which is basically whether or not we needed the end credits sequence of showing the virus, like, taking over the world, and I made the argument that I think that it was necessary because I couldn't see them really getting the point across.
And this is where you're going to go back and admit you were...
I will eat my words, This opening sequence does a fantastic job of, like, if they didn't have that end credits, it does exactly the same purpose. Yeah, so I'll eat my words there.
It's more important here because it's relevant to the fact that we're about to watch a post-apocalyptic movie. We have to explain why we're here. Whereas at the end of the last one, it feels like we're tacking this on. When it was, you know, the movie wasn't about that. It wasn't about getting to the post-apocalypse, so... Yeah, but I mean, yeah, it's not a big deal, but it's, you know, it's something that's there. I think when they go into the city for the first time, a little bit into the movie, and keep in mind, this came out in 2014, 10 years ago. This is 10 years old now, just put that out there.
Oof.
This was a year after The Last of Us came out, and I remember thinking that it looks like The Last of Us when they go into that city. I was like, that especially the... there's like a sort of checkpoint area where there's like a gate, and it's got graffiti on it and stuff now because it's clearly old now. But this was clearly something that was set up when they were like sort of filtering people through and setting up, you know,
it says
quarantines.
Like quarantine zone number 9 or something like that.
And I was like, oh, damn, this is so Last of Us. This special. And then obviously now we've had more games, we've had the TV show, so they've actually recreated that world for itself. But
yeah.
It's just what it made me think of. I remember thinking that distinctly when I first saw it. Mm-hmm. So, Caesar tells them to go, and of course they all freak out, because as much as clearly there's been stories and rumors and this idea that something's happening to the apes, clearly it's not been just like widespread knowledge that one of them can talk, right? This is not something right. that's just spread everywhere. So they all kind of like, oh shit, let's go.
I absolutely love that moment, because the more like racist one, he's like, they're apes, why are you talking to them? And Malcolm's like, do they look like just apes to you? Like, they've got a full war tribe here. These are more than just apes. And then it's only once they basically plead to be let go and Caesar grants it. And not just Caesar, but like all of the apes start yelling, go. Like this is the reveal to the audience as well, because last movie we obviously knew that Caesar could talk. This is the first time we're seeing other apes have started gaining that ability as well. And it's even a shock for us at that point, where we're just like, oh no, they're all super advanced now. They all are able to do this.
Yeah. I mean, they don't do too much, and it's kind of a big moment later when Caesar's son speaks for the first time. You know, it feels like a big deal when he actually says something to him. But yeah, I like this a lot. Not only is he speaking, but the idea that they all just sort of like show up and stop, like they're having a standoff. Like, you know, if they were just animals, like they'd probably just be attacking you or running after you. But they're stopping like they're an army, been led by a leader, and like it was very, very organized. And this obviously is what the entire plot spirals out of. The humans were here, of course, because they need power, and there's a hydro dam they want to get up and running to supply enough power to the little community they've got, because, you know, if power goes out, then society kind of crumbles and everyone will start fighting each other. So it's about preserving what they have, which is, funnily enough, what does Caesar talk about this whole movie? About not losing the home they've built, about not losing their society. So.
And that's, I think that's over the course of the movie, Caesar understands that. He sees, like, because he, over the course, we'll get to it, he grants them the ability to work on the dam, and Cobb is just like, dude, who cares about them? Like, that's not, well, you need to focus on apes more than humans. And Caesar makes essentially the point of, like, they're afraid, they're scared, and, like, they just want the same sort of things we want, to be able to survive and thrive. Like, we shouldn't rob them of that.
Yeah, and so, if we deny it to them, and we know this because we've heard the humans have this conversation, the others are like, oh, let's just go up there with lots of machine guns and just kill them all and take it. So Caesar's like, no, they'll just keep coming and fighting. If we try and do this peacefully, then no one has to be hurt. Caesar's his point every time this comes up is like, how many apes are going to die if we fight? You want to fight so bad, but how many apes are going to die if we do that?
Yeah, but Kobo specifically makes the point of like, but we'll win. Like, it's not a thing where we're going to war and we think there's a chance we're going to lose. Like, we show up there, apes are better than humans. We will definitively wipe them out, and then we don't have to worry about them ever again.
Yeah, he does not care about the casualties, though. It's very, very clear. And obviously, a big part of the character plot of this movie is that it's very clear that Koba is not doing this necessarily for the betterment of apes. He maybe thinks he is for the most of the movie. But there's definitely some moments later on where you realize that, oh no, he doesn't care about apes at all. He cares about being in charge.
Yeah.
He cares about being in power.
Koba works for Koba.
Koba is the corrupt politician. He's the, I don't know why I call him the Hitler of the group, but like he...
but it makes sense.
Yeah. You know, he's the one who connives and schemes to take power. And then when someone speaks out against him and doesn't want to like kill someone who's innocent... he kills an ape. He kills an ape that we've kind of cared about over the course of the movie.
Reading the trivia, apparently there is a definitive parallel between Koba and Stalin.
Okay, all right.
So I think that's the dictator you want to go with there.
Well, I don't feel that silly then, at least going with that general, idea.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the ape side of things, where essentially he says, hey, we should go down, we should fight them, we need to show a force. And Caesar agrees. He's like, we're going to do something, we're just not going to get in a fight.
Yeah, he agrees that we have to show that we're strong. Like, he agrees on that, at the very least. Which is what leads to them all going down, some of them on horses, the entire,
full war paint.
Yeah, it's all of them. So when the humans, because they're all sort of living in this one tower, pretty much, in the city. and like obviously they all freak out because they look outside the door and there's just this army of apes.
I love the, when they're driving back into town, they're talking to Gary Oldman. They're like, yeah, there must have been like at least 80. And then as they see this army of apes, Gary Oldman's like, that's a hell of a lot more than 80, Malcolm.
To be fair, they weren't all in that earlier scene.
True.
And plus, they may have been obscured by trees. They were all kind of, you know, some of them were sort of doing the whole hiding behind the tree, kind of not being seen.
Like, you got to have a few stealth agents. You can't just be out in the open with that.
I'm going to be stealthy. Like, they might think they can take on the 80 apes they can see, but this other 200 that are hiding in the trees, oh, they've not got a chance.
Yeah.
Wonder what happened.
I do. It's paralleled with that. I do really enjoy the talks of Malcolm and, I mean, what's his actual name? Dreyfus, I think.
Oh, yeah. What's he called? Gary Oldman's character. Oldman's. Yeah.
I do like the talks between Malcolm there, because it is essentially the same as the talks that Caesar and Koba had, where they say, look, we need to get to this dam. The apes are not going to let us go up there. And it essentially becomes a battle between, do we go up and, like, fight the apes, which is what Gary Oldman's saying. He's like, I'm not going to let us fall back into that. Or Malcolm takes his path of, let's try diplomacy. So you essentially have this parallel on both sides of human and ape, of one group wants to try the more difficult diplomacy route, and the other one wants to try the more casualty-ridden war route.
Yeah, I think what I like about Gary Oldman's character, who's, you know, he's definitely a minor character in this. He's not, like, a major part of the film, but I kind of appreciate that while he is very much on the side of erring towards fighting the apes, he never comes across as comically, like, just villainous in a way that I thought he could be. And I guess partly you don't need him to, because Carver kind of fills that role. But it would be very easy to have him just be bloodthirsty. And I don't feel like he is. I feel like, you know, he's willing to give Jason Clarke's character a chance. He's like, okay, you know what? You've got 3 days. Go and try and do it this way. But if not, we're going to try and take it. We need that power. We're going to fight.
Yeah. You know? So Carver is against the apes because he hates apes. Dreyfus is against the apes because he loves humanity. It's a very small difference, but it is a major one in terms of characterization.
Absolutely. So that stuff's really good. And obviously, one of the things they do here, the apes, the son character, Alex or Alexander, whatever they were calling him in the movie. I don't know how they said it.
Honestly, I don't think they ever really said his name like more than twice.
The boy, right?
Yes.
The boy dropped his bag, and he's got like sketchbooks and things in it, and he was very upset that he dropped it when they ran away from the apes at the start. And it, you know, Caesar brings it back. Like, when they do this standoff, and Caesar gives them the message, like, we don't want war. We live over there. You live here. Don't come back, and we'll all be happy. And, you know, he has, I think, is it his son that goes out and like throws the bag down to say, hey, you know, here's your bag back. And it's this sort of gesture of goodwill, but also clearly shows that they have more intelligence than perhaps that, you know, the humans would expect them to.
Oh yeah. So, well, that's what I was kind of expecting. I forgot in this movie that they do make this huge show of force, not just in front of Malcolm and the group, but like all of remaining humanity, as far as they're aware, like all of San Francisco.
Yeah. And the Bay Area, at least. Yeah. We don't know how many pockets of humans there are, but we know there's some other ones.
Right. So I actually was surprised that, like, he made these announcements in front of everyone. So everyone now knows, there's no way of hiding it, that there is a group of apes who are super intelligent to the point of being able to speak up in those mountains. And I love how the next scene is Gary Oldman basically trying to calm everyone down. But, like, immediately you get this sense of panic of, like, oh, my God. This is rupturing everything in my worldview. Just the entire group is just in panic now.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because on the one hand, I think Caesar's right to assume that some of the humans might try and keep it a secret from the rest for possibly even good reasons. Like, maybe we don't want to cause panic, so maybe let's not tell them there's this army that if they choose to fight us would probably wipe us out. That's maybe not something you want to tell them. But at the same time, maybe it's also a bad reason because they want to manipulate everyone by not giving them all the information, kind of thing. You know, there's multiple ways you could look at that, but Caesar's making it very clear to everyone that there's no chance of anyone not understanding what the deal that's being made is here, what he's proposing to everyone.
You could just feel that if they had the technology to do it, he'd be handing out pamphlets. He'd be like, here's what we expect from your side. Here's what we'll do on our side. Have a nice day.
Yeah. Just on the humans a little bit. This is kind of like sprinkled throughout the movie. I just want to talk about all these elements here. So Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell's characters are a couple, right? And she's kind of the stepmom of the son. I like this, as you realize kind of why this is that they're immune to the virus, right? This is why all these humans are still alive. Just the X percentage of the population just were immune to it and they're still alive. Yeah. But that doesn't mean the entire family's lived, because I think that's maybe your assumption when you first see them. But what you find out is that, no, before the apocalypse, these two weren't together. They had their own families, and most of their families died. Jason Clarke was lucky enough that his son was also immune, but it sounds like she had a daughter that wasn't so lucky. You know, that's brought up in a scene. So I kind of appreciated that, like, it was very random who got to survive, almost like a Leftovers or a Thanos snap, where the people that were left weren't neat and tidy, but they've kind of formed new relationships since. Because, again, it's been 10 years. There's been time for that to happen.
Yeah. It feels like the whatever gene there is of resistance to this flu or this virus is, like, recessive. So it feels like the new society that's coming out of it, all of them have this gene, so therefore all of their offspring will also have the gene. But it wasn't a guarantee, because it was recessive, that if one parent had it, the child would not necessarily have it as well. So, like you're saying, Jason Clarke's son, he got lucky, he had the gene as well, but that's not something that would have been carried over throughout everyone else.
Yeah, sure. And they do there's a little moment when they get power back later in the movie where Gary Oldman, like, he can finally look at his photos again because it's on a tablet. And I sort of like that little touch. It was like, oh yeah, like, this is the problem with digital photos. If we ever go into a post-apocalypse, you can't look at them anymore because the power's gone. Oh, dear. Nah, so
that's I won't bring it up when we get to there, but when the power comes back on, like, all of it shows the entire San Francisco area is basically back up and running. I love the implication here, though, that for, what, like, 7 years, 8 years, something like that, Gary Oldman has had this iPad plugged in, waiting to charge. He's just been hoping for it to come back on.
Yeah. So from this point in the movie, though, the apes go back, and Jason Clarke wants to try and go and talk to them because they really need this power. So he goes up, his girlfriend and his son come with him, and a few of the guys, unfortunately, can Carver, because Carver's the one who has like experience with, like, hydro dams. He knows how they work, so that's why he has to go, which is obviously good for the conflict that we're going to get, but it's unfortunate for the characters in the story.
Yeah, I love how the characters call it out before they even leave. They're just like, do we really have to bring him? And they're like, yes, I'm sorry, this sucks.
So Jason Clarke is up on his own. There's not a stop, you know, whatever, but he walks up to the camp on his own. And this was one of those scenes where I forgot how beautiful it was shot, with walking up and it's raining and there's this little pathway and, like, all their sort of, like, you know, all of their structures are made out of, like, spears and, like, bamboo sticks. Well, not bamboo, but, like, you know, it's all that kind of style. And you don't see any apes until eventually a gorilla just kind of, like, slinks out of the background behind them. And, like, he's just kind of freaking out. And he's got his hands up. He's down on his knees. And he's, like, sort of basically begging. So he's like, hey, I want to show you why we come up here. Please, you have to see it. Maybe you'll understand. Come on, let's do this.
And Koba's, like, standing behind him, just being like, kill him! Do it! He's lying! This is all a trap! Get it over with!
Human lie! I think that's actually one of the things I really liked. I think it was before this scene, actually, when they were first talking about what to do. Because I think it's when Maurice is looking at the sketchbook from the bag, when they're trying to decide what to do about showing force. Is, like, Koba saying things like, oh, we have to go and, like, win or they'll be back, we'll have to beat them. And it's kind of gaining a little bit of traction. People are, you know, the apes are starting to kind of, like, sort of all kind of grunt and grill about it and be kind of like in support of him. And that's the moment where Caesar kind of snaps and goes, no, and, like, kind of, like, makes it clear that we're not going to do that. And I kind of like that even from that point in the movie, you get the sense that Caesar's trying to keep a lid on this. Like, he doesn't want them. It's not even so much about the humans specifically, but he's seeing them all turn, like, bloodthirsty in a way that is, you know, well, uncivilized, I guess, to use a word.
I think it goes back to the way that he saw humanity as. He saw humanity towards him being very violent. They're like, we are not that. We are better than that. And we will continue to be better than that. And he, obviously, Caesar himself is better than that. But he kind of applies the way he sees the world onto all of the apes. He says, this, we all agree on this, right, guys? And everyone just kind of nods. And they're like, yeah, that sounds good. But obviously, when you're up against it, the people like Koba come out and they're like, okay, but like, we need to take a stand here. I also really appreciate that Koba is essentially an uncle to Blue Eyes, and Blue Eyes really like takes a listening to what he says, even against his own father. It feels like a rebellious teenage sort of thing.
Yeah, but you know, we didn't even mention when the gunshot goes off earlier on, his friend Ash gets shot in the shoulder. I mean, it's not a serious gunshot wound, but it's basically, it kind of plants this seed that throughout the film, he's kind of been influenced by Koba. He's responding more to Koba's desire for vengeance and violence than he has his father. He doesn't understand why his father's been so peaceful and trying to avoid it. So,
yeah, it's revenge is something that is very understandable. It's something you see your best friend getting shot and you wonder, like, he didn't do anything wrong. Why is this person, why is this group not being punished for this? And it's essentially just a little snapshot of, like, a radicalization pipeline.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It's how you sway someone into your ideology. You kind of, like, almost appeal to the most base, like, animalistic, you know, desires in them and say, hey, they're wrong and you're better and you deserve to succeed and you deserve to stand tall above them, kind of thing. And it feels like Koba's really kind of doing that with and very overtly later on in the movie, where he's clearly just trying to plant seeds in his mind by making suggestions. Early on it's more natural, but later on he's actually like manipulating and abusing it. So it's not a super funny movie, of course, but I do get a big laugh when he takes him to the hydro plant. And he's explaining, there's like a good 30 seconds where he's just sort of like pointing at things and going, if we can get this running and there'll be power and we can do this and this all gets, and this will generate this and this will do that. And then it just cuts to this really static shot of Caesar and all the apes behind him just staring blankly at him like they just don't give a shit. We don't have power and we're fine. Why do you need this? Why are you so desperate for this?
That's the thing. I think it's funny because Jason Clark, he thinks, because it cuts to that shot and he thinks like the apes don't understand what in the hell he's talking about at all. He's just like, you getting any of this? And that's when Caesar gives like a sigh and he's like, the lights, yes, we get it, so what?
I just thought that was really funny because it was just kind of like, wait, this is what this is all about. But of course, yeah, to humans it is very important. I mean, hell,
oh yeah,
I'd want lights.
I mean, without lights we wouldn't have patreon.com/mildfuzz.
Exactly. And you can help keep them on by going to patreon.com/mildfuzztv. So,
yes. Yeah, no, I like this sequence because it is, again, it comes down to a debate of like, okay, you say that you need this and Caesar like reasons it out. He's like, look, we're going to let them do this. We're going to give them some time to work on it. But he does give them the one condition that absolutely is unbreakable. No guns. If they're here just to fix that thing, they should not need weapons at all.
Yeah, very fair, I would argue as well.
Yeah.
So they hand over their guns and you see the apes breaking them up, right? They have no intention of using the guns, which is, again, kind of a big deal because later Koba is going to actually go out of his way to get a gun to use it. And, you know, I think that's a big distinction to make here.
I do like much earlier on when Maurice is teaching the baby chimps, you see written on the walls essentially like they're laws, as it's number one written on the wall is ape shall not kill ape, and there's a couple more written beneath it, but I really like that idea that the number one thing of their group is non-violence. Essentially, it's they can show whatever force they want, but they are not the same level of savage that they see the humans as,
for sure. And of course, as soon as you see that at the start of the movie, it's like a giant Chekhov's gun effectively of ape is going to kill ape. Like that is definitely happening before the end of the story. That was the condition, and they get a camp there, and this is where Carver starts being all racist about the apes and trying to even provoke the others into racism by saying the flu is their fault. And Kerry Russell points out it's called a simian flu because they were testing on chimps and that's what created it. It's not really their fault they were being tested on.
And then he just interrupts her and he's just like, I don't care about your stupid bleeding heart stuff. Like, I just hate the apes, okay? Let's just get that clear.
I think the exact line is, enough of this hippy-dippy shit. He referred
right, exactly.
The sympathy for the apes is hippy-dippy shit.
Not even the sympathy. The actual truth of it. The actual of, here is what really happened that we can verifiably say. And he's like, I'll stick to my propaganda. Thank you very much.
He's a flat earther, isn't he?
Oh, no doubt.
he's a flat earther. He's anti-vax. He's every box you could probably put him in. He probably is that.
We see that during the like news broadcast at the beginning, we actually do see Obama in there.
Well, it's some repurposed footage, I assume. Yes.
Yeah. But I if this did happen in 2016, I have to fully assume that like the election was in the run up for Trump at that point. Like. Maybe this all happened before the election happened, so we didn't have to like go through that, but you just know he would have been like a full on Trumper as well.
Now I'm not sure which timeline's the better one. if this stopped that.
Yeah, no, it's 50-50.
So they go to work on the dam like the next day, and they're doing stuff. It's a whole thing. And of course, one of the sort of the touching moments that I think you get here is that there's like a part of their plan is they have to do a little detonation somewhere, but it ends up like trapping a bunch of the guys who are all sort of crawling through these tunnels, including Carver. Yeah. And of course, it ends up being the apes who save their lives because the apes are like lifting all the rocks out of the way to get them out. And it's this thing that Carver almost, you can almost see the pain in his face of like, wait. An ape saved my life. How do I process this? I don't want to thank an ape. I can't do that.
I was going to say, I remember there being an Onion article or something like that where it's like the worst possible thing has happened. A person you hate just did something good.
Yeah, and I think that even comes after the whole... That does come after because they're all dirty from it when this happens. When Caesar's young son is like hanging around... And starts kind of makes friends with both Kerry Russell and the son, and kind of like is just sort of hanging out with them, and it's all kind of sweet. And to the point where, at the campfire scene the night before, when he was being kind of racist about the apes, the other couple of like red shirt guys, to for lack of a better term, just the other guys that are there to help, they're kind of on his side. They're not being as like strong about it as him, but they're kind of like more on his side, and they're not really sympathetic. But one of them notably kind of smiles during this scene, where he kind of is like, "Oh wait, you know what? This chimp's kind of cute, and clearly this is, like, these aren't just animals. He's now empathizing with one of them like a human being."
I mean, they literally just saved possibly his life, and then we get to see a cute little baby version. Like, yeah, no, there's no way you could be against him here unless you're completely irredeemable.
Yeah, so the idea being that the more skeptical ones are being won over, and, maybe friendship here is possible. And sure enough, when Carver is caught having snuck a gun in his case, like the other guys are like, they all treat him like he's the asshole now. Like he is thoroughly viewed that way by everyone.
Well, it's even if they view it selfishly, he is still the asshole because like, even if they don't like the apes, he was willing to put this entire operation to save their entire civilization at risk just because he doesn't like the apes.
Yes.
Like, he's that self-centered about it. So no matter where you come down on, yeah, he's the asshole.
Which, by the way, I always remember distinctly the visual of Caesar when he takes the gun from him.
Mm-hmm.
Just Caesar like actually holding it like he's going to shoot it. Just, it looks like a badass action hero. I'm almost like, I want like Commando, but with an ape as the action hero based on that visual.
That would be amazing. I want it so much because it's a great visual because not only is it this tension thing because you don't know what Caesar's going to do in the situation because the whole reason he's pissed off, not only is there a gun, but Carver, in trying to conceal the gun, essentially kicks away his infant son and then pushes his older son down to the ground as well. So he's personally offended by Carver's antics here. And then he finds a gun. He's like, what am I going to do with it? Nobody knows. I'm a crazy ape with a loaded shotgun.
Yeah, and he tells them to get lost. And the only reason why they're eventually able to go back to working on the dam is it just so happens two things. One, Jason Clark can't help himself. He tries to go up and apologize and plead and try and make amends.
Yeah.
But it just so happens, and this has been sort of like seeded throughout by this point, that Caesar's wife, I don't know if they're technically married, if they're actually marrying each other. But,
they
you know,
seem to be, yeah.
For lack of a better term, if they're not, has been sick ever since the birth of the baby. Mm-hmm. And like she seems to be getting worse. And because Jason Clark sees her like this and Kerry Russell's there, they're like, hey, she's sick. How long has she been this way? And immediately says, hey, we've got medicine. We've got antibiotics. This seems like something that might be, you know, quickly solvable with that. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they treat the wife. And this is sort of like a big gesture. It's obviously a big enough thing where Caesar's like, okay, you can have one day, which clearly is not enough time. But then Caesar says, apes will help. Like, we'll help you with all the manpower work.
And this is the first time that they talk to each other. Like, Caesar's very emotionally open because he believes his wife is about to die. Like, that's inescapable at this point from his point of view. And he talks to Malcolm and them about trust. He says, like, look, I don't trust you. I don't trust humanity in that way. And they say, we get it. 100%. You shouldn't be trusting us. But we're going to do this for you anyway and hopefully try to, like, mend that rift a little bit. And I think it's sweet on Caesar's side that he allows them to continue working at the dam. He tells them, like, look, if you can get it done in a day, have at it. But that's even before he sees if the antibiotics are going to work. It's just the gesture of it.
Yeah.
It's this idea that they were willing to help him out and his family, that he's willing to help them out in return.
And even the fact that it works, like, one day later, this dam's powered on and it's effective. It shows what them working together, these two groups coming together, what they can achieve if they do actually work side by side. And maybe Caesar and the apes don't need the power in the way that they do, but even Caesar seems to enjoy the fact that he hears music again, you know, because this little petrol station turns on and there's some music playing and the guy goes in and puts the CD in and they all kind of like, oh, this is great. We've not heard music in a while, you know, because... I mean, they say they've got, like, diesel generators they've been using, but I assume that they've been rationing it so much that it's just for lights and, like, bare essentials.
It's the reason that Gary Oldman's iPad isn't charged. Like, he's not going to waste it on that sort of stuff. It does feel like the ideal situation here is maybe not full, like, integration with each other of ape and human living together, but, like, they could be open to trade. They could be open to giving each other things, like... Obviously, I feel like hunting and getting, like, fresh meat and stuff like that would probably be an issue for the humans because they aren't up in the woods. Yeah. Clearly, the apes could give them some of that. And then in return, humanity would have their own byproducts using technology that they could provide.
Yeah, so, if nothing else, letting them go up and maintain their dam every so often and they can help, you know, with basic medical needs because it's something the humans have got access to.
Yeah,
there's just, you know, some simple trades here that could benefit both parties quite
look
immensely.
I don't know when the apes are going to develop their own Jonas Salk in order to get medicine underway, but it probably is going to be a while, so let's let the humans help us out there.
And who knows, maybe even if let's say in the dreamland where this movie doesn't go the way it does, maybe Jason Clark says, hey, if you want us to hook you up with some lights, so you've got some lights at night, you can. There's no reason why you can't have some lights.
Like, look, I don't want to say too much, but you've built your entire civilization out of dry wood, and you use fire, so maybe we can help out with that a little bit.
Absolutely. So, during all this as well, Koba...
Far back rewind.
Yeah, it's just because it was separate. Koba, instead of going in the first... When they first start working on the dam, Koba decides to peace out and goes with, like, two of his cronies who are sort of loyal to him. And they go across the bridge, this, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge, so it just firmly reestablishes that that's where we are. Yeah. And they want to go see what the humans are up to because they don't trust them. And it was actually mentioned in a previous scene by Gary Oldman when he's trying to, like, reassure everyone that, hey, because FEMA and the military left a huge stockpile, we actually have a huge armory.
Yeah.
So Koba and the other apes see this. They see the humans testing out all the machine guns and stuff like that.
Yeah, it specifically said that when they send Malcolm up into the trees, they say, you got 3 days. I'm going to go test the weapons to make sure they work. Because if you're not back in 3 days, we're going to take that mountain. So if Malcolm succeeds, none of this is going to be used at all theory, but they don't know that. The apes aren't aware of that. All they see is the humanity is getting their weapons ready.
It's the sort of thing where I can understand like both sides of this like point, because I can understand why Koba would see this and could say this is unreasonable. They're basically immobilizing, and that's not right. Like, that's not trusting. Not that Koba's looking at it that way, but that's just, you know, to play devil's advocate. Yep. However, at the same time, though, I think Koba is looking for any reason. I think if Koba saw one guy with a slingshot, he'd be like, they've got weapons, they're coming for us, we must kill them all. Like, he would. The fact that he sees, like it's almost like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's all these crates, but nothing of but weapons. Machine guns, explosives, the whole nine yards, like a cannon at one point. Later on, there's a tank. I don't know if you see that in this scene, but it's there later. So they've got a whole thing. There's tons of shit.
I obviously it doesn't line up perfectly, but if we've got Koba representing Stalin, I feel like if we just continue the metaphor of like Cold War and stuff like that, this is the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is we've got this huge amount of weapons right off the shore of us and a bunch of people willing to use them. Clearly we should be worried about this, right, guys? And everyone's just trying to say like, no, it's defensive, it's not anything else. But like, if you don't trust the other side, then how are you going to resolve that, you know?
For sure. But yeah, bonds are built. When Koba comes back and wants to...
Sorry, I need to say this scene because I love this scene so much. Koba gets caught.
I was going to come back to this later because there's like a follow-up to scene with the other guys, but
I love the intro to it, which is there's two guys who are just shooting the guns at like a tank or something like that, and Koba gets caught by them, and they start freaking out. They're like, oh, it's an ape, oh, what do? We got to get someone. Do we shoot it? What's going on? And Koba just stares him down like he's pissed off looking, and then as soon as he realizes like, all right, I don't have another way out of this, he plays the circus chimp. Like, he blows a raspberry and he starts like clapping his hand and asking for food. He goes back to acting like a stupid ape, so that way he can essentially get off scot-free. I love it. I don't know why I love it so much, but I love the fact that Koba is that level of conniving, where he's like, I think these humans are so awful, but I know that they think that I'm an idiot, so I'm just going to play up to their expectations.
Yeah, I think part of it, just to go a little bit deeper with it, is this idea that he has such a low opinion of humanity because of what they did to him. I think he enjoys getting away with this. I think he enjoys feeling superior by tricking them like this. And like you say, it's a sign of his conniving to come. These guys don't seem like amazing people, but they also don't seem like the worst either. Like, there's nothing to suggest that they're awful people other than they're laughing at the ape a little bit.
I would say the fact that they didn't immediately shoot Koba means that it's not like a just hatred towards apes for being apes sort of thing.
Ignorance, sure, because they're not taking them seriously, even despite what they've probably already seen.
Right.
But, you know, it is what it is. So when Koba comes back, he hears that Caesar's working with the humans at the dam, right? They're doing the whole dam thing. And Koba comes in and yells for him. He threatens the Cody Smith McPhee's character first, the son. And then Jason Clark steps in. And it's actually Maurice who steps in front of him and being like, you back down, Koba. We're not doing this now.
Maurice is the goddamn best.
Well, I think at this point they've also already... not paid off yet, but they've started the little thread that Maurice is kind of befriending the son character, because he takes an interest in the book he's reading. And then the later scene is that Cody Smith McPhee is effectively trying to teach him how to read this like graphic novel or whatever it is. He's like sort of explaining it and showing it to him.
Yeah, I love that scene because he's like walking him through word by word. But obviously, as we saw earlier, Maurice knows the alphabet. Like, he's able to like write and spell and stuff like that. The only thing that he takes time to explain is, like, turn a phrase. So at one point, the boy's just like, yeah, you know, we were hanging around. And Maurice is like, hanging around, what does that mean? I don't know. And he's just like, oh, you know, relaxing and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, I got you. Okay, continue.
It's kind of, it's nice and kind of like a thematic level. The next generation in theory, could work well with the other side kind of thing. The idea that each generation will become more and more integrated, and that's kind of the hope that everyone always has for these things.
Well, that's the thing with like racism and stuff like that, is that it's always taught. It's always the previous generation that instills it into the next one. So if you can have enough of a generation that is working with the people, that understands that there is no reason to have that, then it just gets eradicated, like, almost instantly.
Yep. Unfortunately, that's proven very difficult in the world, but...
Yeah.
I thought this was kind of a sweet little relationship to kind of develop here. Koba, basically Caesar shows up when Koba's yelling for him and is like, starts making accusations, says, Caesar loves humans more than apes. You're a filthy human lover. And again, this idea of this correlating to bigotry and, you know, just imagine like a racist person, you know, saying you love X type of person, right? And saying that they're a race traitor for doing so. It's that kind of attitude that he has here.
Yeah. And I love the specific wording he uses here. Caesar is able to brush off a lot. He's like, oh yeah, you think I love humans more than apes. I know that's not true. But he specifically calls out, you love these humans more than you love your own son. And that's the part that Caesar's just like, all right, Kobe, you're going down.
It's like, I almost think that part of it is a little calculated, and that he's realizing that he has to show force in front of the other apes to kind of like maintain the alpha status, if you will. But
every single time that there is one of these fights, he like looks around at the group first. He's like, are you guys like listening to him? Do I have to show you that he's wrong?
So he beats the shit out of Koba, punches him, and he stops himself, right? Because he's clearly still pissed off. As much as I'm saying there's a little bit of a calculation here, he is clearly upset by this, and holds off and says, no, ape does not kill ape. And
so this shot where Koba's on his back, his face is bleeding, and he's like looking around at the group who's like turning away from him because he's been humiliated. This was the first shot in this movie where I just said, that's a real thing. Like, there is no CGI there. Like, that shot looked so brutally real to me that it just immediately took me out of that, like, tiny little valley of, what is it? Uncanniness. The uncanny valley.
Yes.
Of the CGI. Like, that was just 100% real to me. I was so impressed by it.
No, I completely agree. This is one of those moments where you can just see the performance and, like, everything else kind of melts away. And I think this, from a character motivation perspective, is the moment where he starts to plot. This is the moment where he feels humiliated. He doesn't like how Caesar's doing things.
And he fully believes what he saw as well, but Caesar's just not listening to him. Like, he's not going to take his advice seriously of these guys have guns, so he doesn't even bother telling Caesar about it by the end of it.
Yeah. And he does the whole, you know, hold the hand out thing. And Caesar goes to, like, he's hesitant, it takes him a minute, but he does go to give him the payoff to it, which is to say, okay, we're good now. Mm-hmm. But Koba, notably, like, as soon as the hand contact, he pulls away. Like, that's it. That counts. I'm off.
Yep.
Like I'm not doing any more than I absolutely have to. Mm-hmm. And it's from this point here that he is just straight up scheming. You know, he's on his way back to the city to go and steal some guns.
Yeah.
And
he specifically tells, he starts talking to like his Blue Eyes, and he's like, hey, your dad doesn't trust me anymore, but like, the humans are dangerous, and you need to be the one that lets him know that. You need to be the one that understands that, because otherwise they're going to kill your dad.
Yeah, he specifically says, I fear for your dad's life, which is notable, because to me that is the first part of the scheme, like him putting that idea in his head. He's setting up the idea that if Caesar dies anytime soon, the humans are the ones who did it. And that's, of course, the entire scenario he tries to make up. He gets a gun because he wants it to look like a human did it. And it's a really good moment, because Caesar's been teaching them all that apes don't kill apes. But here's Koba trying to kill Caesar. Obviously, he fails. Caesar does survive it, but he doesn't know that. You know, he takes the shot. So, honestly, before we got to that point, it is mostly just the stuff we already kind of mentioned with the lights coming on and, like, them... Yeah.
They succeed at the dam, and then they're just camping out. Like, they're invited back to the ape hometown thing, Cordelia has now recovered as well.
And yeah, and I think what I loved about this scene is, yeah, the wife has recovered, but also the body language of Caesar, where he kind of puts his hand around, I can't remember if it's Jason Clarke or
I think it's Malcolm, yeah.
Yeah, or Kerry Russell, but whoever's next to him, he's got like one hand, one arm around his wife, and then the other arm around a human, and it's very much like, oh, the perfect harmony is just about achieved. Like, we're here. Yeah. They've invited them over for dinner, right? They're completely socializing now because of the success of this day. And, of course, that's why it's so tragic that this is the very minute that Koba decides to strike.
It's the rule of narratives. If all of your characters are happy, something's about to go horribly wrong.
And one of the beautiful parts of this as well is that before he even takes the gunshot, he gets his buddy to start a fire, which obviously burns down the entire home, which is one of the very things that Caesar's been adamant about saving the whole time. And yeah. I think this is something that comes up a lot when you talk about dictators or people who are hungry for power, is that they say it's for the good of their people, but this is a good example of him willing to burn down everything that belongs to his people because it will grant him the power that he wants. Like, this is about him being able to get his vengeance and be in charge.
Whatever problems you have with Game of Thrones, one of the quotes that come out of it is, chaos is a ladder. And that is 100% true here, where he's sowing this discord, he's sowing this anxiousness and misery amongst his own people so that he's able to immediately jump in and say, I know how to fix this, and I'm able, just put me in charge and I will fix all of it for you.
And of course he leaves the gun and also the hat that belonged to Carver, because he's killed Carver. I mentioned this kind of in spoiler-free section without saying what it was, but it's when he's in the car, because he's been exiled away from everyone else. He's not allowed to be there, and he's got his lighter, and the glow of it hits like Koba's face as he like sort of like so appears, creepy. And it's such a good shot. As is when this whole home place is on fire, and it's Koba basically like standing in front of Blue Eyes, Caesar's son, and kind of like embracing him and saying, we have to get vengeance for your father. We have to do this. And he's basically rallied the majority of the apes, because in the span of like 2 minutes, their home's burning, Caesar's been killed apparently by humans, we have to go fight. So let's go fight. And this leads us into our big set piece.
I love, though, and this is the point where I was like, oh, like Maurice standing up and defending the kid against Koba.
This is the first time we hear him speak, right?
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, the very first time that we ever hear Maurice speak, it's Koba's making this big thing saying, like, humans killed Caesar, humans burn home. And Maurice just turns and looks at the group that's standing there and he just says, run. And I'm like, ah, Maurice, you are the coolest.
Yeah,
I love you, man.
I think what I love about it is that it shows that Maurice doesn't think they're responsible. He clearly thinks that, no, like, this is going to turn the apes against them, so they have to go now. Like, they have to get out of here.
I think he knows that, like, this group is not responsible, but even he doesn't know that it was Koba who did it.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, he thinks, like, okay, yeah, another human killed you, but he's smart enough, he's intelligent enough that he knows that the actions of the individual do not represent the group as a whole.
Absolutely, yeah. He doesn't, like, even if another human did this, he's not blaming this family for it. He's not blaming them. So they make a run for it, and so basically just sneak out during the chaos. And this gets us to our big set piece, which is the apes all go to the armory, which is near the bridge. They steal an armory full of guns, basically.
Yep.
And we get the sequence
bunch of
where
horses.
The apes ride down the street in San Francisco, firing machine guns at the tower where all the humans are, who are firing guns back.
Because they got the warning when the armory was raided. They were like, the apes stole our guns, and they're coming here.
So there's just gunfire all over the place. Apes are going down, humans are going down. And, you know, you're noticing here that Blue Eyes is sort of looking a little bit horrified at how many apes around him are dying. Like, there's clearly, that's a part of this here, is that he is not... He does not think this is fun. He does not think this is good. Yeah. He's not happy to be involved in this.
Yeah.
The big money moment, though, is that eventually the humans have a tank, and Koba, after he rides his horse through a wall of fire, which also looked fantastic, might I add.
Oh, yeah.
Koba jumps up out of the tank, and just before he jumps out of the tank, we start this shot where the camera is basically bolted to the top of the tank. And if you imagine a tank, the top half can spin around in 360 degrees. So it's basically just the camera's unbolted out of that, and it's just spinning. And it's not even just like it goes round once. It goes round like three times in total, probably, as Cobra's like beating the guy to death who was manning the gun. And then he goes inside the tank, and whoever was driving the tank tries to crawl out, and he gets pulled in. And then, like, it's just this beautiful... But as it's spinning, because all this other fighting's going on around in the street, and all the gunfire and the apes and the horses and all that, and the fires everywhere, it's phenomenal. It's one of the best single shots in a set piece of the last, like, 15, 20 years.
Like,
easily.
If this shot were in, like, a World War II movie, any sort of, like, Band of Brothers sort of thing, I'd be like, yeah, no, it fits there. It's good. It's solid. And I would compliment it there as well. But the fact that it shows up here in a Planet of the Apes movie, I'm like, ah, oh, God, you went over the top here, Reeves, for no reason, but I love it.
Oh, yeah, Matt Reeves earned a reputation with this movie.
Like, yeah.
And I think, you know, we reviewed The Batman, which is what he did after his two Apes movies, and very highly praised that as well.
Oh, yeah. How long was that review? That review was like 3 hours?
Oh, it was a long review. We're also big Batman fans, so there was a lot to talk about, but also a lot of passion. There was the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which, funnily enough, he did bring Caesar into that movie. He brought Andy Serkis with him.
That's true, he did.
Yeah. Funny, he worked with the previous Jim Gordon in this movie, and then he took his Caesar and made him the next...
I mean, on a long enough time scale, Alfred. Everybody's going to have a link to Batman somehow.
That's probably true. I bet you Kerry Russell's voiced an animated movie.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I'm willing to bet you. Maybe even Jason Clarke as well.
I don't think Jason Clarke did, because I just looked over his filmography. I didn't see any, but I guarantee you, like, there's some, like, 2 degrees of separation that everyone here is connected to some DC project.
You know, actually, having said that, she doesn't have that many credits in the last decade, mainly because a lot of that time was spent on The Americans, which was, like, 6 seasons. No, she's not voiced any DC characters. Oh, no, wait, 2009, no, Wonder Woman, yep. Wonder Woman, she voiced Wonder Woman.
Everything on a long enough time scale hits the DC universe.
Dude, that's quite funny. I can't believe I made that call and then landed the shot. Okay.
Yep, there you go.
Very good. That sequence is spectacular. Yeah,
absolutely. And the final part of that on that single one-er is the tank colliding with, like, the wall of their facility and knocking the doors down, so the apes are able to get in to where the rest of humanity currently is.
Yeah, and that leads to the apes rounding up the humans as prisoners. And we find quite quickly as well that Maurice Rocket and other loyal to Caesar apes have been imprisoned as well, because Cobra doesn't trust them to not go against them.
That's the number one thing when you're setting up a coup, is you take out all of the loyal people and you install your own puppets.
Yeah, and quite quickly, you know, you've got Blue Eyes and Ash, Rocket's son, with him. It's like the next morning, and like this human's like just scared and swinging a bat at them to defend himself.
Yeah.
And Cobra comes down, pins the human down, and he's about to hit him, and he goes, you know what? No. Here, Ash, kill the human. You know, he's like, you know, and I almost like the idea that Cobra's speaking so much by this point in the movie, because he's trying to prove that he can do it just as well as Caesar. Like, it's not because he wants to speak like humans. It's that he wants to show that he is just as capable, if not better, than Caesar.
Yeah, I mean, he's slowly been building up his speech over the course of the movie, but it definitely feels like once he took control of the group, he's not using sign language at all. He's screaming out orders.
Yeah, and Ash, like, just throws the thing down and says, no, this is not what Caesar would want. And Cobra comes over, puts his arm around him, like, friendly, but then it turns and he grabs him by the back of the neck and drags him kicking and screaming up the stairs, picks him up and throws him over the ledge, and Ash is thrown to his death. And Blue Eyes witnesses this, and it's like, wait a minute, what happened to ape not killing ape? Obviously, they don't know he killed Caesar or tried to kill Caesar, right? So that, to them, it's like, wait, what?
Well, that's what Cobra says. Rule number one now, apes follow Cobra.
Yeah, that's rule number one. That's the most important rule, is that Cobra's in charge.
Yeah,
don't question it. So they've
got all the humans in cages, but then back up in the woods, we have our little main group that made its escape actually stumbles across Caesar's body in the woods, and they realize, oh crap, he's still alive, man.
So they get him into their truck. Caesar because they can't go back to their place because clearly it's on fire from the distance, Caesar directs them to his house from the first movie. Yeah. It's a really nice little reveal because the window is very distinct in the attic. So
yeah, and that is something I did notice throughout the original home of the apes here. That symbol with like the star in the circle is etched into like a bunch of their rocks and like wood and stuff up there. So it's definitely a symbol that they're using to represent ape culture, or at least Caesar as a whole.
Yeah, so he gets to recuperate here, and obviously he's very down at this point in the movie. Jason Clark needs medical supplies to help him. So he actually, we have like a sort of fun sequence where he sort of sneaks in around all the apes, like rounding up the humans to put them in cages. And he's
I guess this is another oner, or at least a faked oner.
Yeah,
he's following through the halls.
Through the halls, yeah, because he sneaks into the subway and then comes up. And of course, he does eventually run into an ape, but it's Blue Eyes. And Blue Eyes at least has seen enough of this guy and the way his father's treated him to, he doesn't like yell, he doesn't like shoot him. He just kind of backs down.
I didn't read it that way. I read it as, this is like Blue Eyes doesn't want to kill anymore. He doesn't any of this. I don't think it mattered who the human was. I think it's specifically like he holds up his gun. He's ready to shoot. And he's like, man, screw it. This isn't what my dad would want.
That's perfectly fair. I just mean that, you know, I think it's, you know, it has a bit more impact because it is someone he recognizes, because it isn't just a faceless human being. And I think when Jason Clark effectively, not doesn't beg, but he gives him a little sort of like, look to be like, hey, please don't.
I'm trying to do something here. Please don't hurt me.
I think seeing that fear in his face more than anything is probably what triggers it. But then Jason Clark says, hey, your dad's alive, by the way. come back with me. So,
which, all right, I meant to bring this up earlier, but I'll bring it up now. All of the apes felt really well done. I think that CGI wise, all of them fit into the scene well. It felt like they all were very well done, except Blue Eyes. I feel like throughout the movie, Blue Eyes is the one that just always felt a little bit removed from the scene. Like the CGI just wasn't quite finished for him. Am I alone in that?
I can't say I felt that, no.
Okay, that's fine. It's just something about it. Every time I looked at him, I was just like, maybe it's because he's supposed to be like a teenage ape rather than like a like looking like Caesar or Koba's sort of age. And so it just kind of hit me wrong. But I don't know. It just didn't feel like his CGI was quite up to the same standards.
Like I say, I noticed moments here or there where you could maybe tell a little bit in general. But I don't know if I attributed that to any particular ape.
Okay, just noticed the most with Blue Eyes. Yeah. Like, that's Caesar felt spot on, and maybe that was because Andy Serkis's face was just perfectly acting everything through it, but Blue Eyes I just had a bit more issue with.
But yeah, he goes back and sees his dad, and it's sort of this heartfelt reunion kind of moment where he's very apologetic about following Koba in any way and explains what's happening now. The big thing here, though, is that he does kind of speak for the first time in the movie. He speaks to his dad, which obviously kind of means something to him.
Yeah, Caesar basically says, like, look, I in order to take this back, I need to be strong enough to beat Koba. Because as much as I've been trying to push forward, apes have good ideology, we do still go after whoever's strongest. Like, I need to win in a fight. And he knows because of the gunshot, he's too weak to fight Koba.
And take some responsibility here for, like, you know, I never saw this coming because I never could have imagined, like, us stooping to the same levels that some humans do, but clearly we're just alike. Like, clearly Koba and his whole thing is very similar, and it's almost as an extra layer to the tragedy that he's that way because of the cruelty of humans. Like, humans almost passed it on to him.
Well, that's a line that he says when Blue Eyes says, he's saying like, hey, Koba says that we should fear humans, and Caesar says the only thing Koba got from humans is their hate.
And he finds out, you know, the women and children didn't come with the apes, but they're being called in now. But he sends his son to go and basically free Maurice and the others, right? All the loyal apes for Caesar. So he goes off to do that. And meanwhile, Caesar has like a sort of heartfelt scene where he goes up to the attic and he finds like a little video camera And it was like the footage that was being filmed early on in the first movie, yeah, where he was being trained how to speak in sign language.
I felt like throughout this movie, we've had this sort of sub-narrative of Caesar trying to be a good father to Blue Eyes. Mm. And obviously he's going through like rebellious teenage years and stuff like that. He's being slightly radicalized. So there's an issue with the communication there. But I feel like this really brought it all home of saying like, look, no, fatherhood is never quite what you imagine it to be. It's always going to be a little bit difficult because obviously look at what ended up happening between James Franco and Caesar by the end of it. Like Caesar went off to start a whole new life as King of the Apes, more or less. So there is this looking back at his own childhood, I think is him reflecting on his own relationship with his own son at this point.
Yeah. I also think James Franco's character never imagined he'd be the father to an ape when he was thinking about his future years gone by.
Enough.
It's a sweet scene because Jason Clarke mm-hmm. witnesses a little bit of it and asks like who this guy was. And this is where he straight up says he was a good man like you. And clearly this bond is kind of formed, this trust, like he's earned Caesar's trust here, and it's this idea that there are good people, which makes it all the more tragic the path that we're now on because this conflict has happened. Right? You know, I mean, when we get to the end of the movie and they're saying their goodbyes, Caesar straight up says, apes started this war and man will not forgive that, so this war is now happening. Like, you know, so it's like we've been past the point of no return, and that's the tragedy. That's the tragedy. It's like we've got these two characters from either side who want to live in peace with each other, but he's saying you have to go because when your military or whoever's coming comes with their weapons, this is going to be a war. Go now. That's where the movie, you know, builds up to.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing I wanted to say about this scene, though, with James Franco is apparently he was interviewed after this movie was released, and he said, like, oh, yeah, you have a little cameo here. And he's like, no one told me. I was not contacted for this. This was all just old footage from the first movie. They just had the rights, so they did it.
He doesn't have to be contacted for this because it's their footage.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. But it's amazing to me that no one told him right up until the end that they were using that footage again. It's just like, hey, buddy, you're in the movie.
No, it's effectively stock footage. I mean, if they do anything where they use like his image in a way, like his likeness, that's new, then they have to, like, you know, pay them for it.
I'm not saying legally they're not in the clear. Clearly they are, but I still feel like someone should have told him at some point. They're just like, hey, by the way, you're in the movie now, whether you like it or not.
Let's say they did that thing like during the opening when it's explaining the virus. Let's say they threw on a couple of clips of the previous movie.
Oh, well, yeah.
Building up. Like, that would be like the previously on sort of clips. Like, no one would expect it for that. I think this is kind of a similar vein to that.
It's a similar vein, but it's also like the emotional, like, crux, the big emotional point of the movie. I feel like he should have been notified. If I was in James Franco's position, I would want to be told.
He's got bigger problems than this.
Well, yeah, nowadays, sure.
Yeah, I think what I like about its connection to the first movie is that this movie's so different. It's evolved and doing its own thing, but it never feels like it's at the expense of the first movie. It always feels like the first movie's history is very important to what's going on with this character and what his story is in this film, but it never feels like, oh, we're trying to like do the same structure as that first movie, or we're trying to do the same type of story. It's very much a true evolution where, no, it's a different story being told, but and that is the history of this now.
Yeah, there's so many different franchises and movie series and stuff where you get a new writer in, and either they copy the exact same thing as what worked before, and they don't bring their own thing to it, or they already come in with an idea of what they want to do, and they say, canon before this be damned, I'm going to make my vision work. And I think this is this beautiful little thing in the middle where it takes this backstory, it takes all of this setup from the first movie, and it says, okay, how do we continue from there? And it really flows naturally from that.
It's almost like sometimes when you switch creative forces that there's almost contempt for the previous movie, and there's not a single lick of that here. It feels like it's honoring everything that movie did, but doing its own thing and adding its own important ideas to the mix, and I think that's really good. So
yeah,
yeah. The whole thing is that we Jason Clarke sneaks Caesar and his little team of apes back into the city, into the building, through the tunnels. He gets cut up because Gary Oldman never got captured, so he's actually planting explosives underneath the tower to just kill all the apes in one big fail swoop. Yep. And he's like, hey, come help us plant this C4. And Jason Clarke at one point in the scene just has to sort of casually go over, pick up the gun and start threatening them, be like, hey, I gotta give him time to finish, right? We gotta give him time. And he's like, who are you talking about? Give who time?
Yeah. I love how Jason Clarke delivers this, because he picks up the gun first, he aims it at them, and they're like, what are you doing, man? And he's just like, we gotta give him time. He's up there, he's trying to fix it right now. And at no point in this does he ever just like explain the fact that there's a civil war going on between the apes, and like if his side wins out then everything's going to be cool. He just keeps on saying like they shot each other, they thought he was dead but he's not dead. And I'm like, oh, you're just a crazy person now. Okay, you're a crazy person waving a gun.
It's the heat of the moment. Okay, it's the heat of the moment.
Yeah. It does strike me that Jason Clarke's character like never really held a gun before. He's always been this pacifist type.
Oh, yeah, this feels maybe the first time he's ever held a gun, to be honest.
Yeah.
that's just reading into it maybe a little bit. But so Caesar climbs up the tower, and as he's getting up there, a lot of the apes are starting to see him, and it becomes this standoff where Cobra like jumps down, and he does throw away the gun because, you know, Caesar kind of makes a little gesture as if...
Well, he baits him. He says Caesar weak, and then Caesar looks at the gun and be like, Cobra's weaker. You need that gun to fight me?
And we get this fight, but of course, within like seconds of this fight starting, Cobra's using a weapon. He's like picked up a pipe and starts trying to swing that at him. He's using dirty tactics constantly throughout the whole thing. He clearly has no, there's no honor here. He is the villain. He is absolutely the villain.
I mean, it just goes more to say with the ends justify the means. It doesn't matter how he wins, but if he wins, he's in charge. So he's going to do what he has to.
Yeah. At a certain point, Gary Oldman just suicides himself to set off the explosives at the bottom. But they didn't finish planting them, so it doesn't take everything down, but you get a big sort of bit of fire coming up and stuff.
But we do have the one guy who's been running communications ever since the electronics started back up again. He apparently, according to Gary Oldman, made contact with a military force that is now coming to San Francisco to fight the apes. And that's where that war that you were talking about building at the end comes in.
So the end, I mean, the fight's really solid, right? I feel like it's one of the weakest parts of the movie in some ways, because it's just the fight as opposed to everything else, but it's still really good, right?
I think the strength of it is that it shows once again the difference between Cobra and Caesar. Cobra at some point gets this huge gash on his like rib cage off to his left, and Caesar knows that he's not able to beat Cobra in a one-on-one just who's strongest fight right now, but he uses his smarts, he uses the intelligence that he does have to constantly keep on hitting that gash because he knows it's Cobra's weak point right now, and he uses that to get the upper hand on him.
It's the ending that stands out for me, because eventually Cobra's like high enough the ledge, right? This is the big climax to
everything's exploded. We also have a bunch of apes have been caught in the wreckage, so Caesar goes to like free the apes that have been caught in the wreckage while Cobra's still focused on the fight.
It's very much a Superman fight where Superman has to save the civilians but the bad guy doesn't, so
he's also pulled back out a gun as well. He's shooting him again.
He's doing dirty tactics left and right, and there's a lot of chaos here. Like, at one point they fall, because this building was still under construction, so a lot of this upper levels is like, it's just like temporary wooden like boards, scaffolding, stuff like that. So they're breaking all this apart as they're fighting through it. But eventually Cobra's dangling off the edge. And basically Cobra, one last time, tries to play the game. He tries to appeal to and manipulate Caesar by saying, ape does not kill ape. And he puts up his hand for Caesar to help him up. Caesar grabs his hand, he looks around at everyone, all the other apes, looks back down at him, and then hits him with the most... Well, it's not even that the line itself is badass, it's Cobra's reaction that I love, because he looks down and says, you are not ape. And the look in Cobra's face as he realizes what that means is just beautiful. So
persona non grata Wee.
So he just drops him, and they make this especially brutal because he hits a cable, which sort of slingshots him, and then he lands on a bit of scaffolding that then falls apart, and then just falls into the smoke below. You don't see where he lands.
I as soon as he hits the cable and he like hits that scaffold, the scaffold catches him for a second, and I'm like, dear Lord, are they still not going to fully kill off Koba? And then the scaffold starts collapsing as well. I'm like, okay, never mind. He's gone.
No, no. They just wanted to give him a brutal death that he deserves. Yeah. That's all this was.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and that leads us to the final moments of the goodbye between Caesar and Jason Clark's character.
All the women and children apes end up arriving into the city. The humans, meanwhile, during all this, the ones who were caged were actually freed by... I guess you call them the Resistance, Caesar's loyal apes.
Yeah, Caesar's...
They freed them.
Caesar's, again, I can't want to say men, but Caesar's apes.
Yeah. So wherever humanity is at this point, it seems that they've kind of scattered to the winds.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I guess if I have a... Not a nitpick, per se. It is maybe a little strange that you don't see Kerry Russell and the son again, like, one last time at the end, because the last time you saw them it was at the house. Obviously, they had a heart-to-heart. Early on when she like talked about her daughter and like, you know, finally said, hey, her name was Sarah, kind of thing. But
I'm not sure what story arc they would have like had here that they could have really wrapped this up on. But I do think that having Caesar's, one of his last shots being with not only his son, but also his wife and his newborn child. I think having Malcolm also share that probably would have been a good job to like really solidify that final parallel between the two of them.
Instead, they go for this thing where Malcolm, after they have their whole moment, and you know, Caesar pulls them in and does the head touching kind of like, you know, so it's a very, very touching moment, literally, I guess.
Yeah.
Malcolm sort of like just sort of fades into the shadows of the door. Like, he sort of goes out of the dark. So there's this idea that he's never going to see him again and that he has to go away. I guess maybe you could have slightly reframed this. It wouldn't have been as urgent because it wouldn't be right after the fight, but reframe this to be when they're actually leaving, so you could have the other characters there because they're about to go in a truck and leave. But, yeah. I mean, it's not really a complaint so much as just that I do notice that we don't see them again. The last time we saw them was before the fight and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, as soon as Gary Oldman blows himself up, you don't see another human besides Malcolm for the rest of the movie. So, and that's a good, like, 15 minutes, I would
say. That's true, yeah.
So...
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, again, it's what we went back to in the last movie is that it very much was Caesar's story. I think that it's smart to focus more on this idea of Caesar fighting against Koba and the ideological battle between the two. But I don't think it would have hurt the movie at all to at least get a little like last shot of these extra characters that we've built up because idea is the parallels between them.
Yeah, I never wanted them to be involved in the fight or anything. I just think it's just a tiny little bit strange that you don't see them one last time before the credits roll. But, it's not a huge deal. It's like a minor little, again, not even a complaint, just an observation observation more than anything else. So, yeah, and the movie kind of ends how it started with the camera going into Caesar's eyes and a close-up. Before it
as
finally
prep for final war with the humans.
Yep. So that leaves us off with Dawn. Dawn is phenomenal. It's it's layered. It's got social commentary. It's got complex characters. All the characters serve a purpose. There's a sense of tragedy. There's characters you want to root for. It's tragic when everything falls apart. And it feels like it parallels a lot of real world things when it does fall apart. And it's meant to be this examination of why people don't trust each other and why hatred sometimes wins and overtakes. And sometimes it's the fault of the people for not predicting that other people are going to act the way they do in these sort of situations. So I think it's very, very layered. And it was very fulfilling the first time I watched it. This is like the fourth time I've seen it, I think. And it's held up every time. And I always forget how epic the big set piece thing is in the middle of the tank. Like, that entire sequence is phenomenal.
I was looking at the time and like the final battle star, I was like, wow, this battle's going to go on for a while, isn't it? But no, it's just two separate fights happening.
Yes, yes. I really can't. I think it's one of the best science fiction movies of this century, this side of 2000.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's totally fair. I remember liking it a lot when I went to go see it. I remember I actually went to go see it by myself because I was the driver for my brother who was going on a date, and they went to go see whatever Transformers movie was out at that time.
I'm going to assume it's a younger brother.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they went to go see whatever Transformers movie was out at that time. I went to go see Planet of the Apes, and I was I don't know.
2014, it would have been Age of Extinction, the one with the Romeo and Juliet clause.
Well, that explains why that relationship did not work out for them. But, I just remember that because of the way the timing of the movies worked out, I was left sitting outside the theater for like an hour afterwards, and I was just like, really like replaying things in my mind. I was like, that was a really good movie. I'm actually kind of shocked at how good that movie was.
It's a really good movie, and that Transformers movie's an hour longer somehow.
Yeah,
and it was that movie's like 3 hours long. It's painfully long.
I remember I was looking at the run times. I was like, oh, okay, 2 hours for Planet of the Apes. I'm sure the Transformers movie can't be that much longer. And then I'm sitting there twiddling my thumbs in the parking lot like, Jesus Christ, kids, movies should be done by now. What's going on?
And this is fresh for me because I had to watch all those last year.
Yeah.
Just before you joined the show, Noelesh, you little prick.
I'm going to, as much as I can help it, I'm going to save those for homework until the very end.
The last six or seven homeworks you do are just going to be all the Transformers movies.
As long as they don't come out with another one, I will do that. Yeah, I'm sure they will. They can't help themselves.
Yeah. All right, what are you rating Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Oh, God. I mean, it's really, 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 really good. I gave the last one, I think I gave it like an 8, and I stand by that, but it does leave such little room to grow above it. But I'd say this one is a solid 9. I think that there is so much to enjoy in it. It's doing a really great job at telling this parable of trust and like misunderstandings and whether or not peace is worth the effort that goes into it, sort of thing, and how easily it can all just be torn away in the end. That's the main thing that I take away from this ending, is that peace is, it only has to falter once for it all to really fall apart, and it'll take God knows how long for it to build back up again. And that's, it's a powerful message. It's something that I think anyone can really look at and say, that's the cost of war. That's the cost of this fighting, is that peace is so much harder to reaccomplish again after the fact. So yeah, overall, I'll give this one a 9. I really did enjoy it. And special effects still hold up. It's been a full 10 years later. I can't, like, top tier stuff all the same.
Yeah, honestly, a lot of movies these days cheap out on the effects. Like a lot of the recent Marvel movies have looked, frankly, quite bad. It takes time, it takes money to get good effects, and this was something that was clearly a priority. When your movie revolves around a lot of characters who are being made up of CG, and they put in the effort, and it's still paying off all this time later, where I'm not saying you can't tell sometimes, but it is such a, it's still maybe the peak of where we've gotten to in terms of CG characters, right? It might not have been top. I mean, maybe War is technically slightly better just because it was a few years later, but like I don't know, we'll be watching it soon. We'll see how we feel. It was at least on par with this visual effects wise, but it may be a little bit better even. So I've bounced around scoring this, and I'm going to go more conservative with it today, just because, you know, if in doubt, go with a conservative number, and it means more, and maybe one day it'll go up, but I'm giving it a 9.5.
No, that's the conservative.
That's the conservative number.
All right,
There has been times when I've thought this might even just be the 10. Obviously, there's a few little nitpicks that I've maybe pointed out here or there, and I think time is serving it well. I think it holds up remarkably, and everything it's doing with its themes, and then obviously the special effects and everything else we've talked about. So,
I mean, the fact that even just the opening, like, 2 minutes of this movie where they're talking about, like, a pandemic that went through and ravaged everyone. And, like, I think there was a line in there where they specifically said, like, you got people who are fleeing the country because of these lockdown restrictions. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man, stop it. You're sending me back to a time I don't want to go back to.
Yeah. I mean, this felt special as soon as I saw it. Like, I couldn't believe coming out of the movies that this was better than Rise. I was so impressed and surprised with how much I enjoyed Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I came out of this one being, holy crap, like, they went another full step above and gave us, like, a new classic just like that. And I do genuinely think it's the best one in the franchise. So, okay. You know?
All right. Well, in a few weeks' time, we'll do War, and then a few weeks after that, we'll see if Kingdom can maybe snap you back again.
I don't know. We're back to that problem of it being a new, unproven director. We'll see how that goes. I'm skeptical. I mean, if nothing else, War absolutely finishes a trilogy. So even if Kingdom absolutely sucks, it's fine. The trilogy's still a full thing. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I'll just ignore it if it's shit. But we'll have to talk about it, so we'll see how it is. All right. So I mentioned at the start, you can get bonus shows over at Patreon. Me and David ourselves do two monthly shows. We have Extra Reels, which is the worst movies of all time. Sometimes they're so bad they're great, but not always.
No.
We have the Criterion Cut, which is actually maybe the best movies of all time, because it's the prestigious movies. It's the it's the Kurosawas and Ingmar Bergmans and stuff like that.
Oh, Pete, sorry. I just, based off the schedule, I looked to see what our last Extra Reels was.
Mm-hmm.
Troll 2 came out last week. So,
so what?
Yeah, that was fun.
That was kind of fun. What was supposed to the tone?
I still am thinking about it, is the problem. We did that like a few weeks back now, and I'm still thinking about it.
David, you can't piss on hospitality, okay? Just
got it. I know you won't allow it. I know.
I will not allow it. I'll have to tighten my belt so I don't feel hunger pains. And your mother and sister will have to do the same. So yeah, you go check out those bonus shows. There's also other bonus content for Screams After Midnight, the horror movie podcast that I do with Tim. And of course, me and David also do Collector's Cut. I think we're in the middle of Ghostbusters season right now, I'd expect.
Yeah, end of this week, we're doing the final one.
Frozen Empire?
Yep.
Is that next up in Collector's Cut? Cool.
Yep.
But we've done seasons of movies over there. We've done 70s disaster movies. We have done all the Christopher Nolan movies, barring one or two that fall into different categories. So go check out the other shows if you want more movie discussions from me and David. Or me and Tim, even, if the case may be. But, all right, David, you have your homework. You watch a movie that we did on Ace before you joined the show.
Mm-hmm.
What was your homework movie this week?
Do you want to take a guess? Do you want to hazard
what you think
I might have done?
Was it Beneath the Planet of the Apes?
It was Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Good job. I'm nothing if not predictable when I can be. For Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I did the original Planet of the Apes for homework with that. And then this one I did Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is the sequel to Planet of the Apes.
I can't wait. Just before you go any further, I can't wait to see where you fit in battle, because you're going to run out of new ones to pair them with.
You're right. I'm kind of just hoping that before I finish my homework, we get the sequel to Kingdom. Like, that's my main goal here.
Because obviously you're going to do a Conquest with Kingdom. And then you'll be like, okay, but what does Battle go with? Battle's the fifth one of the original set. Well, actually, there's also the remake, so technically there's a fifth and a sixth you need to do, but...
I'm saving the remake for if we ever happen to stumble across, like, a Tim Burton or a Mark Wahlberg that I gotta cover.
Well, I've been making up a big to-do list for Ace, and unfortunately Mars Attacks is in there somewhere, so...
There you go. So that'll fit right in. Anyway, Beneath Planet of the Apes. Without spoiling anything too much, it is a... hard turn after the first one.
Well, it is. Hold on. It's a hard turn after, like, there's a little intro, and then, like, 70% to 80% is just a shitty copy of the first movie.
Yeah.
And then it pivots hard into new territory.
Let me be clear. I actually really like what it was doing up until that hard turn. I actually thought that there was some interesting things that they were coming across. They were playing more with the, because obviously people who've seen the first one, it's Earth. We know it's Earth and we don't have to like play with that anymore. But they play with the idea of, okay, it's Earth. So let's explore that more. Let's explore, like, there was a humanity. What does that mean? And I like that right up until they take it too far. Right up until they cross a bridge that I think should never have been crossed. And I won't say what it is, but I will just say it is a bit too far with that. We have our new main character of Brent, who I think is fine. I think he's pretty much milquetoast. He only exists
because Charlton Heston only wanted to do a couple of scenes. So they had to come up with a new protagonist to fill out the movie.
I think I would have been bored following Charlton Heston doing this movie. Like, even if we had it be a similar-ish plot, but rewritten for Charlton Heston continuing his character, I think I would have been bored by it. Introducing a new character, at least, gives a few new things that can be introduced that can only be seen through the eyes of a new character. The part that was getting me, though, that I actually found super interesting, especially compared to with Dawn, is that whereas the first movie was this idea of, can you blend science with religion? Is there a way that the two can coexist, or are they just constantly at odds? This one does the same thing, but it's between the soldier race of gorillas and the, I don't want to say religion, but just the more intellectual side of things. It's trying to say which of these should be the one in charge, more or less. And they seem to come down on the intellectual side, but that just reminded me more of, like, no, there isn't really a place for war in a society that should be more about peace and stuff like that. So I like that aspect. Again, as soon as they make that hard left, they kind of drop that as a focus and instead make it like, no, but who can war the hardest? So yeah,
the only thing I remember about this movie is like some of the stuff from the ending, like what certain characters look like and what they worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, all of that is beyond the point of it should be in a totally separate franchise. Like, there's no reason it should have been in the Ace movies. And then, again, without spoiling anything, this movie ends on the most sudden, like, you would have thought the projectionist just forgot to put in the next reel if it weren't for the fact that we'd been going for an hour and a half. So, yeah, no, I can't say I was a fan of it. Can't say I really, without knowing what the next three movies are, I have no idea how we can continue past this point.
Well, you don't know what, like, the third one is?
I don't know what the third. I've been trying to keep blind to all this. I don't want to know anything about it going in.
Oh, so you don't want me to just give you the taste?
I mean, if you want to give me the bare bones just so I can have a little idea, go ahead.
So, Cornelius and Zula?
Zira,
there you go. Been a while. Mm-hmm. They come to present day Earth.
Yeah, no, I don't like it. I don't like it.
That's what the third one is.
Nope. Like, that, again, it just feels like it's a betrayal of everything that first movie set up. So, yeah, no, I'll go ahead and just rate Beneath for now. I'd say that one's probably, I give it like a solid 5. It's not offensively awful until you hit that last bit.
You can't put the word solid in front of 5.
I'm saying solid 5 in that it's immovable. I'm not going to be able to get it up to a 6, but it also doesn't feel like it's down to a 4 either. It's just right there in the middle of, I enjoyed aspects of the first half to 2/3, and then this last third just threw me on such a ride that frankly I could not enjoy myself anymore. So, yeah, 5.
Okay. Well, if it makes you feel any better, most people tend to think the third one's the best sequel of the original batch.
I mean, that gives me more hope when I get to it, but I'm just waiting for disappointment if you're wrong.
Okay, well, there you go. Mm-hmm. There's some more Planet of the Apes goodness. That is the show, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. We do appreciate it. As I said, hit the like button, helps us out a bunch. And of course, you can get us on Twitter and all the other usual things. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Keep watching science fiction and computer at Salsa.